first session, Dr. David Lewis.
Thank you very much, and once again, I'm very happy and very honored to be invited to speak here, and I've spent about 30 years studying the subject. What I went through yesterday, I talked a little bit about the purpose and calling of Israel, about the history of ancient Israel, and the migrations of Israel from Palestine to northwestern Europe. And as a base, what I wanted to do yesterday, I did not have much of an opportunity to do this, was to go through the identity from the Bible of the 12 tribes of Israel, the prophecies that Jacob gave, the prophecies that Moses gave. And by comparing those prophecies with the characteristics of the nations of northwestern Europe, United States, British Commonwealth of today, to identify who are where the lost 10 tribes are today. What we have, of course, in Genesis 49. If you turn to Genesis 49, there are still many people in various denominations, in evangelical churches, in other churches, who believe that all 12 tribes of Israel are merely the Jewish people today. And of course, as I went through yesterday in biblical prophecy, and what Genesis 49 actually shows, separate destinies, the prophecies of the tribes of Israel in the Bible. And of course, I'm working from the premise here, in all of his lectures, working from the premise that God really meant what he said when he wrote the Bible. If it talks about prophecies that this Israel will be restored in the last days, it literally means Israel will be restored in the last days. There's been a tendency of theologians down through the centuries to allegorize. This began with Augustine and with Tertullian and some of the other theologians in the early Middle Ages to spiritualize and allegorize what the Bible says about Israel and apply it to the church. Others will apply this to the Jewish people. But what we have, of course, Genesis 49, as Jacob was dying, the patriarch Jacob was dying. And I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, which is not as literal a translation as the King James. And what Jacob said, if you look at Genesis 49, and come and I will tell you what will befall you, Genesis 49, chapter 1, in days to come, or the literal translation is, in the last days. And of course, what skeptics will do is they will apply in the last days, in days to come, well, that's just Old Testament times. They sort of kind of feel that God shortchanged Israel. Skeptics will say, I will make of Israel a great nation. Well, they'll just apply that, well, Israel was a great nation in the days of David and Solomon. And they will kind of take this interpretation, which we'd call a minimalist interpretation. That's why many skeptics and many theologians and many others who reject this understanding try to say the Bible just applies to a little group of people long ago and far away and is of no relevance to us today. And I personally do not subscribe to this interpretation. The phrase, in the last days, again and again throughout the Bible, can also include as an ongoing fulfillment the 19th century, the 20th century, the millennium. So Jacob's prophecy, the separate identities that are predicted here, would apply to our day as well. And even you have the messianic prophecy in Judah where it says the Messiah would come from Judah. Well, this took place 2,000 years Jacob gave this prophecy, almost 2,000 years. So this was well beyond the time of ancient Old Testament Israel. And if it could apply 2,000 years in the future, why not 4,000 years in the future, as many other prophecies in the Bible do? But let's go through this. Jacob gathers his sons around him. Genesis 49, chapter 3. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. unstable as water, you will not excel, or better, you will not have the preeminence. Because as we'll see, the descendants of Reuben have excelled a great deal in world history. In fact, excellence is one of the things that, the main traits that distinguishes them. You will not excel because you went up to your father's bed, then defiled it. He went up to my couch. Now, Reuben, of course, the evidence, the identification of Reuben is many scholars who studied the ten tribes, and I wholeheartedly endorse this, is that the descendants of Reuben settled in France. Talk about Reuben as the firstborn. The firstborn had a double portion. The firstborn was given more than the other sons. And if you look at France, traditionally, among the nations of northwestern Europe, historically and traditionally, with the exception of the English-speaking countries, the French were the most powerful country in among the democracies of northwestern Europe. And it talks about my might and the first fruits of my strength. When the nations of Israel began to rise to power, the nations descended from Israel began to rise to power after the defeat of the Spanish Armada, the British did not become the world's first power. It was France under Louis XIV and under the Bourbon kings. The 1700s, the 1600s and the 1700s were the age of France, just as the 1900s belonged to Britain. Well, the latter half of the 1600s and the 1700s belonged to France. The whole world, French was the language of diplomacy. French manners were imitated by all of Europe. All the kings of Europe imitated the absolutism of the French, imitated the manners of the French court. Just trying to, it's a bit blurred here, I'm trying to. France attempted to dominate Europe, and all the powers of Europe combined. What you found, of course, it talks, so during this period, it was France who was the number one world power. France seemed destined to dominate the world. Much of North America, the whole American Midwest, the whole of Canada was controlled by France. The English colonies were hemmed in on the eastern seaboard. The French were penetrating into India. There were even French explorers. One French explorer ultimately, I think, even reached Australia. But there was, France had the finest army in Europe. The finest, what is interesting too about the population of France. France had as many people in the 1700s as Russia. France now has a dwindling population, but in the days shown on this map here, the top map, where it talks about French expansion, France and Russia were the two most populous countries in Europe. So France was the superpower of the 17th and 18th centuries. The excellency of dignity and grandeur. All you have to do is take a visit to Versailles to see the court, the splendor. And the French have always had a flair for greatness. General de Gaulle talked about how France would not, and having French culture was seen as a sign of refinement. As one person said, does France have a civilization? Well, one European said, France is civilization. Much of the English language itself shows French influence. The political institutions of the American Constitution derived from Montesquieu. Ideas of the rights of man came from France. The idea of free market economics started in France. There was a fellow by the name of Jean-Baptiste Say or Frédéric Bastiat. Communism, all the great political ideas originated in France. Communism, socialism, fascism, liberalism, all of these ideas have French antecedents. So the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power, France had all of this. And yet France lost this due to its political instability. Unstable as water. France went through a revolution in 1789. And the result of that revolution was to throw France, made France a democracy, but threw France into such turmoil that France failed to industrialize as Britain industrialized. The French Revolution held back French industrialization. And even though France was a blessed nation, see, France is, France has not done badly as far as world history goes. There's an old proverb, as happy as God in France. The other thing to remember is that much of British power in the 19th century was made possible because the French army was so strong in Europe. Winston Churchill made a comment, thank God for the French army. And so much of British power was exercised in the 19th and 20th century because France was Britain's shield on the continent, even though there was a bitter rivalry between these two people. But the instability of France, the tendency, as General de Gaulle once said, how can one govern a nation with 200 kinds of cheese? You see, in other words, the French people are very individualistic. The Song of Deborah talks about this. It says, among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping of the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. This is Judges 5, 15 to 16. When Deborah and Barak went to war against Israel's enemies, the Reubenites got up in their assembly and they debated. We should intervene, we should not intervene. They were so polarized between themselves and so factionalized. And this has characterized French politics to this day. The French left and the French right, they were always at each other's throat. That's why the French Fourth Republic, talk about unstable as water. The French Fourth Republic went through dozens of governments. France still functioned, of course, because you had a good professional civil service that ran the country. And many of the ministers in these various governments would go from government to government, but you still had a tremendous instability until General de Gaulle came along and gave France a new constitution. Deuteronomy 33:6, let Reuben live and not die either, but let his men be few, nor let his men be few. One of France's biggest problems historically was that of a declining birth rate. This is sort of what's called the French sickness or French difficulty. In the 19th century, remember France was, in the 19th century, the beginning, in the middle 19th century, France and Germany had the same amount of population. Within 50 years after that, Germany had 50 times, there were now three Germans for every two Frenchmen. And the French have one of the lowest birth rates in Europe. It's a problem that the French have always faced as a danger of a dwindling population. It's very much affected them and affected France's power and influence in the world. What I find also interesting about this, where it says, let Reuben live and not die. Another translation of this is, long live Reuben. Long live Reuben. Vive la France. Long live France. You find that this popular slogan. Very interesting. There's also certainly Gauls, of course, who were the ancestors of the French, lived in a place called Gilead. Those tribes east of the Jordan, Gilead or Gaulantus, and the name Gaul itself may well derive from Gilead. And as I pointed out, the river Arnon, which was on the southern frontier of the land of Reuben, the only other place in the world where you find a river Arnon is right in the heart of France. Okay, moving on from France, we talk about Simeon and Levi. The Bible talks about Simeon and Levi being Simeon and Levi as talks about their swords are weapons of violence, and it talks about their anger and their wrath. Simeon and Levi were both. I'm a descendant of Levi, by the way. Interestingly enough, talks about Simeon and Levi, brethren. They're two of a kind. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations, or their swords are weapons of violence. O my soul, come not into their secret, unto their assembly. My honor, me not thou united. Jacob didn't want to have anything to do with Simeon and Levi because of their reputation. They were violent, hot-tempered, racist. They tended to let emotion sway their judgments. Cursed be their, O my soul, come not. And then it goes on to say, for in their anger they slew a man or slew a prince. And in their self-will, they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And this is the fate of what happened. The tribe of Levi had no territory of its own, but the Levites had cities in the various... The Levites had cities in the various tribes of Israel. Most Levites today went south when the king divided and are found among the Jewish people. What you have with the Jewish people are Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. There's a book called Founding Our Fathers, A Guide to Jewish Genealogy. And in that book, it was written in 1978, Jewish scholar makes the point, an expert, that the 10 tribes of Israel, Reuben, Simeon, Ephraim, some of Simeon possibly, but Reuben, Ephraim, Manasseh, are no longer Jewish, that they are essentially in large numbers not found among the Jewish people, that the Jewish people today are essentially the descendants of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. That the Jewish people represent 3 of the tribes of Israel. The other 10 are lost. But of course, the promises in the Bible, as I was going over them a few minutes ago, show the restoration and promise the restoration of the other lost 10 tribes. There's a scripture, Amos 9:9, where he promised to talk about the house of Israel. The whole book of Amos is devoted to the house of Israel. Amos prophesied to the house of Israel, not to the house of Judah. And he says in Amos 9:9, "Lo, I will command and sift the house of Israel among all nations, like grain is sifted in a sieve, but not the slightest of the grain will fall to the earth." In other words, what that's saying is that the 10 tribes would not be assimilated into the surrounding nations, that they would survive as a distinct people to the very end of history. Getting back to Simeon and Levi, so Levi is essentially found among the Jewish people. But where you find there was a large group of the tribe of Simeon that actually went north. The book of 1 Chronicles bears this out. And settled among the 10 tribes. So many Simeonites were taken captive and lost along with the 10 tribes. There are some Simeonites among the Jewish people as well. There are Jews with the name Simon. I once had a dentist and she was a Jewish lady from Hungary and her name was Simon. So there are Simeonites among the Jewish people. But much of the tribe of Simeon went captive, migrated into northwestern Europe along with the Celtic peoples. And you find in Celtic Britain, Margaret Thatcher, when she was prime minister, because she was so anti-European, a lot of her opponents gave her the nickname of Boadicea. Boadicea was a king of the Britons of the tribe of the Iceni, I-C-E-N-I. Now, one of the other names for the Iceni were also called the Cimeni, S-I-M-E-N-I. And the Cimeni, or the Iceni, rose up against the Romans in 70 A.D. and acting just like Simeon, they slaughtered and plundered the Roman legions in Britain and forced the Romans came in with a vengeance, this is around 70 A.D., 80 A.D., and made short work of Britain, Celtic Britain, as a result of this uprising. But this tribe were the Cimeni. And the Iceni, of course, could well be preserved the name of Yachin, Numbers 26:12, one of the sons of Simeon. And essentially, the prophecy about Simeon being scattered among Israel, the Celtic peoples of Europe were eventually pushed out into the fringes. You find some of the fringes of Scotland. You find some of the fringes in Wales. Some of the fringes in the Bretons, in the western part of France. And from that area, many people have migrated to Quebec and to French Canada. And to the American South, you find a lot of Celtic population in the southern United States. And so we see Simeon scattered among the various tribes of Israel. And tending wherever they're scattered, they tend to have a very tribal, sort of a warrior ethic. They were frontier people. They were fighters. They were these type of people. Now let's get to Judah. And I think the prophecies to Judah are very important. If all Israelites today are Jews, wouldn't all the tribes of Israel have the prophesied destiny of Judah? Why would God bless, or Moses bless, every tribe of Israel according to its blessing? If all the tribes are absorbed into Judah, which would be like all of Australia being absorbed into New South Wales, or all of the, or absorbed into Tasmania, or all of America being absorbed into Texas or California. All Jews were Israelites, but not all Israelites were Jews. But you have the separate destiny of Judah. And that destiny of Judah has been fulfilled exclusively in the Jewish people, in the state of Israel, and the Jewish people of today. Not in the other tribes. It says, Judah, thou art he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children will bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rise him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh, that is the Messiah, come. And unto him, the Messiah, shall the gathering of the people be. Binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine, he washed his garments in white, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk. This latter part is a prophecy of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, coming through the line of Judah. But we look at the first part of this verse. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. There's an awful lot of anti-Semitism in this world. More than any other people, the Jewish people have had, what one scholar wrote a book, the longest hatred. It's an interesting aside on this, that there was one British Israel writer by the name of Adam Rutherford, who wrote a very good book some years ago, and he made the point down through history that anti-Semitism is a weapon that recoils against anybody who uses it. One politician once described anti-Semitism in East Europe as the socialism of fools. But because there was a lot of economic prejudice against Jewish people in some of the countries of Eastern Europe. But the point was that every nation, as a general rule, there are exceptions, but as a general, when every nation treated the Jewish people well, they prospered and they became powerful. But when they turned to anti-Semitism and started using anti-Semitism as a political weapon, they were cursed and suffered. I'll give you an example. Spain, during the Middle Ages, under the Muslims, was the most civilized country in Europe. And it was the Jewish people contributed to that civilization under the Muslims. And Spain was the, while the rest of Europe was in the Dark Ages, Spain was the center of literature, of learning, of civilization. When the Crusaders took over Spain and expelled the Muslims and turned the Inquisition on the Jewish people, many of the brightest people left, apparently Christopher Columbus, one of the reasons why Christopher Columbus, who was a devout Catholic believer, but also an Italian Jew by descent. Christopher Columbus, one of the reasons he may have gone to the New World was to perhaps seek a homeland for the Jewish people. I don't know how true that is one way or another. That's what I had heard. But the main point was that when Spain instituted the Inquisition and turned against the Jewish people, she began to lose her power. She gradually, it took a period of a couple of centuries, she lost her power. Same thing, England and France during the Middle Ages. England and France expelled the Jews. King Edward I kicked the Jews out of England. And during that period, they suffered the Black Death, they suffered civil wars, the Wars of the Roses, the Hundred Years' War. When Cromwell allowed Jewish people to come back into England, England began to prosper. Poland, in the Middle Ages, Poland encouraged the Jews to come in after they'd been kicked out of Western Europe. Poland was a superpower. Poland and Lithuania were superpowers in the Middle Ages. The borders of Poland went half the way to Moscow. Poland eventually turned to anti-Semitism and wound up becoming Europe's battleground. And so and there are prophecies in the Bible, which I'd like to go into, about how Poland is mentioned in the Bible as Elam, the son of Shem. And God predicts the captivity and the suffering of Elam, but also the redemption of the Polish people when Christ returns, because Jesus Christ is also the Messiah of the Polish people. Some of my ancestors came from Poland, by the way. But you see this again and again. Russia turned against the Jewish people far more than anyone, and Russia has suffered far more than anyone. And so you find this when Germany treated the Jews well. Germany was very prosperous. It's interesting, before 1914, Jews in Germany were treated very well. Imperial Germany was, there were a lot of human rights. There were a lot of, many Germans look back on the days of the Kaiser in Germany before World War I. It was a golden age for Germany. Also interesting, there were more Jews who fought for Imperial, in World War I, before America came into the war, there were more Jewish people who fought on the German side than on the Allied side, because Jews in Germany were treated, and in Austria were treated quite well. But here we, but that's just a point I want to make. But it says your hand will be in the neck of your enemies. 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, 1982. Israel, despite all the attempts to annihilate the state of Israel, the Israelis defeated their enemies, the Arab nations who sought to exterminate them. Nasser tried to wipe out Israel in 67, and the Israeli armies made short work. And of course, as I pointed out, God is also loves the Arab peoples, and there have been terrible injustices done to the Palestinians by both the Israelis and by the other Arab governments. So it's a very complicated issue that only God can survive, but the important thing was a prophecy here, talking about Judah's great military prowess and Judah's messianic. The Jews are essentially a messianic people. So here we have, and many of these prophecies apply to Levi as well. So here we have the identity of Judah, and the prophecies of Judah basically apply to the Jewish people. Zebulun. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. Issachar is a strong donkey couching down between two burdens, and he saw that rest was good, and that the land it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant unto tribute. Zebulun and Issachar were like twin brothers. They're mentioned together. And of course, Moses talks about them. And of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar in your tents. They shall call the people unto the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness. They shall suck of the abundance of the seas, and of the treasures hid in the sand." Now, one of the tribes that migrated to the Netherlands was known as the Sablonoi, S-A-B-L-O-N-O-I, which is derived from Zebulun. And more than any other nation in northwestern Europe, the Dutch are bound up with the sea. Half of the Netherlands, Zebulun dwelling at the shore of the sea, the Dutch have reclaimed their whole country from the sea. And of course, haven, the word Zebulun means dwelling or implies haven, and the Dutch were the first people in Europe. The Dutch are actually the most liberal people in Europe. Are not the French, not the Swedes, the most liberal people in Europe are the Dutch. The Dutch practiced religious toleration earlier than any other people in Europe. And of course, the Dutch were a great seafaring people in the 1600s, the 1700s. The Dutch, this tiny little country, had an enormous empire, which included Indonesia, which included West Irian and New Guinea, which included colonies in India and in Suriname, in Latin America, and South Africa, of course. The Afrikaners, the Afrikaner people of South Africa, are largely of Dutch descent. It talks about, what was interesting was the symbol of Zebulun was a diamond. And you find, it says that Zebulun would raise treasures in the sand. And you look at South Africa, which is the diamond capital of the world. And from, so you have, and suck of the abundance of the seas. The Dutch, of course, you have the Royal Dutch Shell. The Dutch were great, the Dutch had one of the prime oil industries in the world. They pioneered in that field. And what was I going to say? We have, of course, the stone of Zebulun, as I said, was a diamond. And Now, Issachar was associated, and there are many Dutch people today who do believe in the Zebulunite ancestor. There's more evidence found in a book called Strange Parallel. It was actually made into a movie by a sort of a British Israel group in the Netherlands, which argues very strongly between parallels between yesterday's Zebulun and today's Netherlands. Now, with Zebulun was Issachar. These were twin brothers together. In the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, which was, of course, Jewish tradition, Zebulun was a sailor, built the first sailing ship, had a love of the sea. But Issachar was an agriculturalist, was a farmer. Talk about Issachar being like a donkey between two burdens. And these characteristics may fit the Flemings and the Frisians. It is also possible that Finland talks about Issachar being a servant unto tribute. A book was we talk about Finlandization. And Issachar being between two burdens. The Finnish people, who are at least partly of Israelite stock, you have the Tavastians along the western shore of Finland. And these people, Finland has always been between two burdens. Finland's always been between Sweden and Russia, between Napoleon and Russia, between Germany and Russia. And Finland, in that sense, has always been a sort of an independent satellite caught between East and West. During World War II, apparently, Marshal Mannerheim, who was the commander of Finland, referred to the Finnish people as "you men of Issachar." So I can't really go into a lot of material on some of the minor tribes. As I said, their identity might be a bit difficult to establish. With the tribe of Dan is very interesting. If one wants, looking at historical evidence, there is more historical evidence tracing the tribe of Dan. And Dan is unmistakably, maybe some of the tribe of Dan in Denmark, but Dan is unmistakably in Catholic Ireland, in Southern Ireland. The tribe of Dan apparently migrated very early from Palestine. And a lot of people think, well, these things are just based on folklore. There are two anthropologists. You find, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer's epic, the Trojan War. Homer describes a people in Greece known as the Danans, or the Danai, or the Danans. They were a warrior people in Greece. And two ethnologists, there was a British ethnologist by the name of R.G. Latham, and even Yigael Yadin, the famous Israeli archaeologist, recognized and admitted that the Danai of Greece, of the Iliad, were none other than the same people as the Israelitish tribe of Dan. They were essentially the same people. A Greek historian by the name of Hecatus of Abdera, he made the following statement. He was quoted as having said, "Now Danaus and Cadmus," Cadmus was the Canaanite Cadmonite. See, there were people Israel did not exist in a vacuum. There were people going back and forth across the Mediterranean all the time in ancient times. The Philistines in Gaza came from Crete. They were of Greek origin. Any history book will tell you that. Israel did not exist in a vacuum. And what he said was, Hecatus said that Danaus led the Danans from Egypt while Moses led the greater part of these people into Judea. Here was a direct reference from a Greek historian and two modern archaeologists linking the Danans of Greece with the Danans of Greece with the ancient Israelitish tribe of Dan. Now, Irish annals, it's very interesting. You go to the Book of the Taking of Ireland. It was a very old book by Geoffrey Keating, Geoffrey Keating's History of Ireland. People tend to poo-poo and ridicule folklore and legend and tradition. This is part of the skeptical approach to history. But every legend, any good historian will recognize in any legend, in any bit of folklore, that there is a grain of truth behind it. Folklore and legends just don't spring out of nowhere. And what Irish legend records is that the Danans, the Tuatha de Danann, who were a Celtic people, who are the ancestors of the bulk of the Irish population of today, the Tuatha de Danann. Tuatha means people or tribe. De is of, tribe of. And Danann was the goddess Danu, or actually the patriarch Dan. There was an old Danish chronicle, according to the Irish legends, the Danans left Greece. They said that these were none other, the Tuatha de Danann were none other than the Danans of Greece, whom I've already shown was the Israelitish tribe of Dan. And the Tuatha de Danann migrated up the rivers of Europe. They migrated up into Russia and came through Denmark. There was an old medieval chronicle, the Holstein Chronicle. And it says, the Jutes and Danes are Jews of the tribe of Dan. Says that, right? This old Danish chronicle. You can find it in Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons in a footnote. But the Danes preserve a tradition of Israelitish origin, as do the Swedes. And of course, so we have the Irish legends. We have Greek historians, we have anthropologists. The tribe of Dan were the Danans, the Mycenaeans, some of the early peoples of Greece in the Iliad, and the Irish, the Tuatha de Danann, are directly descended from those people. So here is strong historical evidence that Ireland is Dan. What's also interesting, this is from Henri Hubert's book, The Rise of the Celts. The coracles, or the boats, they're like these little boats that these coracle boats that the Irish use to sail in and go fishing in, are identical in form and shape and style to boats found on the Euphrates. So there are strong traditions. The psaltery is none other than a bagpipe. You have the tartan, which the Scots wear. And I can't go into it, but there's an element of the tribe of Judah, which actually settled among the Highland Scots. You have the island of the Hebrides off the coast. And the Scottish, another tradition, Celtic tradition of coming from the Middle East, is found in the legend of the Milesians, or the Scots, who followed the Tuatha de Danann into the British Isles. And the Milesians, they have one of their ancestors was Eber Scott. E-B-E-R. Eber was the ancestor of the Hebrews. And you find the name Eber occurring in the old Irish annals. I mean, where do they get this stuff from? And even if you fabricate these legends, they have to be based on something. But you also have, and the Scottish declarations trace their people back to the Near East and back to, they said that the ancestors of the Milesians or the Scots helped Moses at the Red Sea, or they were there at the time of the Red Sea. So we have these traditions of Middle Eastern origin among the Scots. So that's the tribe of Dan. Of course, it talks, Dan shall judge his people. And the Irish have always had a talent for politics and law enforcement. You have the Irish, many Irish would go into police work and this sort of thing. Of course, Gad. The name Gad means troop or militia, and that can be identified with Switzerland. And while other countries were a country with an army, Switzerland was an army with a country. The Swiss, universal military training for every Swiss. And it talks about fortune, or Gad being, the term Gad. Well, the Swiss were the free market entrepreneurs of Europe. You'll find this even to the Swiss are incredibly prosperous. There are virtually no poor people in Switzerland. They don't let them into the country, for one thing. They're very strict. Switzerland has the toughest immigration laws in Europe. Every few years, the Swiss hold a referendum to kick all foreigners out of the country. But unlike the other countries of Europe, which tend to be more socialist, the Swiss are very entrepreneurial. They have a very free market system. They have social programs that are privately funded. They have direct democracy. It's very interesting. One of the sons of Gad was Ari, A-R-I. Well, Uri was one of the cantons of Switzerland. Okay, Asher, another tribe, was a borderland people. It talks about Asher, it says, his bread shall be fat and he shall yield royal dainties. Another borderland people, you have the Walloons of Belgium. You have this region of what, in Europe, you know the color of Burgundy. Well, Burgundy was a land in between France and Germany. And it included Champagne in France, and it included the French-speaking part of Belgium, where the people are called Wallons or Walloons. They speak French, but they're not French. They look different, they act different. The French go into a restaurant to solve the problems of the world. The Belgians go into a restaurant to eat. The Belgians are the gourmets of Europe. royal dainties. And Burgundy was the land, the idea, of course, champagne. In other words, dainties for kings. And you have this area of Champagne was a land of castles. It was a land of chivalry. The whole idea of knighthood and chivalry and the rituals of chivalry came out of there. The castles of Europe came out of that area. There were many castles in that area. Champagne, many of the luxuries for kings came out of that area. It's very interesting. I found this in a history of Belgium, where it was in French, Histoire de la Wallonie by Leopold Jenico. He was a Belgian writer. And it quoted a medieval chronicle from the city of Liège, which is in the heart of French-speaking Belgium. And it quoted the blessing to Asher from Genesis. In the Middle Ages, was quoting the blessing to Asher to refer to Liège. And Asher, of course, was also the borderland of Israel. It said, talks about iron and brass. And the Belgians were the industrial leaders of Europe. While the British were industrialized on the continent, it was the Belgians who were producing the locomotives and the railways and the steel. So Belgium also, one of the sons of Asher, two of the sons of Asher, one of them was called Eber or Heber. And you had a tribe in Belgium called the Eburones. Naphtali, of course. It's interesting, the name of Naphtali or Nephtalim. How much time do I have, by the way? Got 8 minutes? Okay, well, Naphtali, I'm afraid I'm going to have to talk about Ephraim and Manasseh yesterday. But Naphtali, of course, settled in Sweden and Scandinavia. It says, Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. In other words, they were diplomats. The tribes that settled, one of the tribes that settled in, I have a map here from the geographer Ortelius. I'm trying to dig it out if I can. Here we are. There was a people that migrated out in the, if Israel was supposedly destroyed, you have a people with the very name of Naphtali. Just as you have the very name of Dan. This was Ortelius, who was a geographer of the 1500s, and he produced the map. This is essentially Russia, a very crude map of Russia. This was the Dardanelles down here in the Black Sea. But you'll notice Naphtali here and Danorum here. This is on an old, early modern, late medieval map showing that Dan and Naphtali had migrated way up into northern Europe towards Scandinavia. And in Central Asia, at the end of antiquity, the 5th, 6th century, the people called the White Huns or Naphtalite Huns, who are the descendants of Ephtalite Huns, just put an N on front of that, Naphtalim. The very name of Naphtali preserved among these people. And the descendants of Naphtali are essentially found in Scandinavia, particularly in Sweden. There's also a history of Sweden written in the 1700s by Olof von Dalen. Olof von Dalen, he traces the ancestors of the Swedes back to the 10 lost tribes and to southern Russia, where Israel was taken captive. And Benjamin, of course, as well. Benjamin... The descendants of Benjamin, many of the descendants of Judah and Benjamin were also taken captive by the Assyrians and migrated into Europe along with the lost 10 tribes. And what is fascinating is in Denmark, you had a tribe called the Jutes, J-U-T-E-S, or Eudoses, E-U-D-O-S-E-S. And these people migrated and settled in Kent. And Ripley's Races of Europe, Ripley was a very detailed, thorough British anthropologist of the 1880s. And Ripley analyzed the people in Kent. That's the corner of England down by the White Cliffs of Dover, down southeast of London, where the Jutes had settled. And he said, the people of Kent look Jewish. Their faces look Jewish, and I cannot figure out why. So you have Jewish people, the people of Kent look Jewish in this corner of Kent. The other thing, of course, was with that tribe, closely associated, was another tribe of wolf people, or Varini, V-A-R-I-N-I. They had a wolf for their symbol, migrated and settled in Norway. And the biblical prophecies about Benjamin, that Benjamin would raven as a wolf and plunder as a wolf, and take the prey and divide the prey, fit the Vikings exactly. What's interesting is the settlers of Iceland. There was the old Icelandic legends. And even the legends of Odin record, the Yingling saga and others record Odin leading multitudes of people from Turkey, from southern Russia, from Scythia, around 200 AD. Odin was a king, and he led these people. In the very era Israel had been scattered, he led these people into Scandinavia. That's part and parcel of Scandinavia. And the archaeology of Scandinavia confirms this. You have Scythian motives on archaeology, and also on Anglo-Saxon archaeology. It's very interesting what's come out in the last 15, 20 years. They have found, this is a book called Second Millennium Archaeology. I think Wooten was the author of it. I don't know. But he looked at the archaeology of the Anglo-Saxons, and he found strong resemblances between Anglo-Saxon pottery and that going back, and pottery of the ancient Near East going back to around 1200 B.C. What are the Anglo-Saxons, 2,000 years later, doing with this kind of medieval pottery, or kind of ancient pottery? This map, by the way, is quite important. It comes from a book called The Hittites, People of a Thousand Gods, by Johannes Lehmann. Unfortunately, I won't get a chance to go into Ephraim and Manasseh too much in this lecture. I covered some of that yesterday. I may take a when period is open for questions. I might talk a little bit about that. But the Israelites, of course, have been taken captive to Syria with the Assyrians. And when the Assyrian Empire fell, both the Assyrians and the Israelites became refugees. The Assyrian army moved westward into this area. And what these dots and things show, what these things show are statues of bullocks, of the Hittite storm gods, of the ancient Near Eastern storm gods, of Baal, essentially. And you can see a trail from the very area where Israel, and presumably the Assyrians, disappear from history. You can see a trail of these artifacts moving upwards into Central Europe and Western Europe. Here you see an archaeological trail. You see an archaeological trail of these artifacts moving north and west into Europe. Again, here's archaeological confirmation of the peoples from the Near East, and specifically Assyrians and Israelites migrating to Europe. You found that the Hittites, who lived in this area with whom the Israelites and Assyrians mixed, spoke an Indo-Germanic language, identical to that spoken in Hesse, like the word Essen, to eat, in German was Etzuvatna, in the old Hittite language. So again, here is, from Lehmann's book, archaeological confirmation of migration from Asia into Europe. I'm going to have to break off there. My final lecture, I want to talk a little bit. Mr. Rhodes was talking about the British Empire, and I want to kind of put a corollary on that and add to that this afternoon, talk about America in Britain's place, looking at the 20th century as the American century.
If anyone has any questions for Dr. Lewis, we do have a little bit of time. If anyone would like to ask any questions.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And I just wondered, I had heard that they may have been sent to the Uruguay.
That is possible. Wales is a mixture of people, but there was, like Lewis, my own name is a very common name in Wales. You have, like, my original grandparents' name, great-grandparents' name was Halevi, but when they came to America to escape the anti-Semitism, my great-grandfather posed as a Welshman. And the Welsh have many of the traits of Levi, of being very emotional, very fiery. They love music. Yes?
The Welsh language, I've heard, is very close to English.
Yes, I've heard that. Well, it's a book, Lysons' book, Our British Ancestors. He wrote that in the 1860s. And Samuel Lysons was no British Israelite. But he pointed out a tremendous number of Hebrew words, like you find place names in Wales, like Aberfan, and A-B-E-R, like Eber. And the Iberians were the people who went into Wales. Eber, E-B-E-R, they were Hebrews. And there's a river in Wales called Gargan, G-A-R-G-E-N. You find a similar river down in the area of the Caspian. Now, in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, it referred, when they were short on Levites in ancient Israel, they said, let's go to the place called Casiphia, which is on the shore of the Caspian, and bring back a priest, bring back a Levite. So having an identical river name in the area of Casiphia and also in Wales would suggest it is possible that some of the Welsh people, not a majority, not all, but it's possible that there could be a pocket of the tribe of Levi in Wales. And, of course, the Levites, like Moses and Jeremiah, they tend to have a very prophetic view. And you find a lot of the Welsh traditionally tended to be very fundamentalist. They would have their chapels rather than the Anglican church. But also the backbone of the Labour Party, of the Socialist Party, Britain, the Labour Party, were Welshmen. There's also the bulk of the Welsh, though, there was a book, I believe, by Camden or Nennius, who was a traditional British historian. He said that the Welsh were descended from the Israelite tribe of Asher. In other words, they were coal miners like the Walloons. So you could have, in Wales, again, a mixture. That name Cymru is very interesting. The Welsh called themselves Cymru. Cymru was the exact name the Assyrians called the Israelites. The Plaid Cymru of today is the Welsh Nationalist Party. It's doing quite well. They picked up a lot of seats. Wales now has its own assembly. And Cymru, or Cambria, that's where you get the Cambrian period in archaeology. Cambria is derived from Cymru. And the name Cymru in Wales comes from the Assyrian name for Israel. The Welsh have their own traditions, their triads. They said that Hugh Cadern, or Joshua the Mighty, led us from the land of summer, which is where Constantinople now stands, to Wales. And that was the area where the Cimmerians and the lost Israelites had been scattered. Yes? Yes. 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 Very much so. Very much so. Particularly among the Highland Scots, the red-haired Highland Scots. Harry Golden, he was a Jewish writer. He wrote a book very interestingly. And of course, there is, from the Scottish traditions, very good evidence tracing some of the Highland Scots back to some of the Jewish colonists that had settled in Egypt. Because, in other words, they came through the Mediterranean. But there is and Tartan, you know, Scottish. A Tartan was an Assyrian general. You see the Tartano, you'll find, even looking at the ancient Assyrians, you'll find soldiers in the Middle East wearing kilts. The Psaltery is none other than a bagpipe, you see. I had an article, there was material on the Highlanders as part of, see, there were two branches of Judah. There was Zara and Pharez. Pharez was the ancestor of the Jewish people, but the descendants of Zara became known as Milesians, became wanderers among the nations, wandered to the Mediterranean, wound up the people of Scotland and Ulster. You have the people of Northern Ireland. You will see on the Ulster flag, the flag of Northern Ireland, you will see a Star of David. You'll see a St. George's Cross. Yes, this gentleman has... no credence whatsoever. Number one, test it, the latest thing, and I want to talk a little bit about this. There's been a theory that has unfortunately rears its ugly head from time to time. And this is the concept that the Ashkenazim Jews, the Jews of Eastern Europe, are not Jews at all, according to this theory, but Turkish Khazars. And you'll find people will argue that because the Turks are Edom, and therefore the Khazars are Turks, therefore the Jewish people of today are not really Jews, but another people. They are Turkish Khazars. And Kessler, of course, before he wrote this book, was dabbling heavily in the occult. This was one factor. The other factor is the prophecies, as I pointed out, about Judah embrace and include both Sephardim and Ashkenazim Jews. The Jewish people of Europe, and Yiddish, of course, which is a German dialect derived from German, not from Turkish. Judah Halevi, who visited, see, many of the Khazars, the leaders of the Khazars were Turkish people, visited them. And it appears that only the leaders of the Turkish people converted to Judaism and eventually abandoned that. And the Khazars are still there in Eastern Europe today, among the Turkic peoples. They did. There may have been a small element among the Khazars that did migrate among the... It's possible that some Jews are of Turkic... few in Eastern Europe are of Turkic descent. But overwhelmingly, the Jews of Poland, the Ukraine, Russia, and the Ashkenazim Jews, the State of Israel, people like my own family, are descended from Judah and Levi, not from the Khazars. The other thing, recent DNA studies have been done on Ashkenazim Jews. And these DNA studies clearly confirm that the Jews are Jews. The Jewish people of Eastern Europe are Jews and not... this theory is very unfortunate because it has led to a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. The old British Israelites never taught it. It's something that percolated into British Israel writings. There's a certain amount of Aryan and Nazi ideology, and I hope I get a chance to go into some of this in the final lecture. A lot of that stuff, Aryanism and Nazism, began to percolate into the understanding of many people who believed in Israel's identity in the 20th century. But you won't find that in writings by Adam Rutherford or John Wilson or the old British Israelites of the 19th century. But the smoking gun on this are the prophecies of the Bible, which clearly show the people, the Israelis of today, who are largely, a lot of them are Ashkenazim Jews, are Jews. And DNA studies, I wish I could have brought a copy of some of the material, recent DNA genetic studies have absolutely confirmed that pretty well all Jews, Sephardic and Ashkenazim, all the Jews from both Spain, Africa, the Arab countries, and the Eastern European Jews are from Judah. They are Jewish people. They are Israelites. They are not Khazars. Any other questions? Or should I, or do we have time for it?
One more.
Of the what people? Cornwall. They're definitely Celtic. They're definitely Celtic, definitely Israelitish. Likely either descended from Judah, Asher. See, the original Celtic migration that went into Britain went there before Israel was taken captive. There was a story, you go down to Plymouth, and this is where the first Celtic settlements in Britain around Plymouth, that's where tradition says that Brutus and the Trojans landed in Britain. Now, a lot of people would dismiss the stories of Trojans coming to Britain as absolute fairy tales, except that archaeology shows the earliest Celtic settlement took place exactly where Brutus came into Britain. So it's possible that the people of Cornwall could be descended from Judah. Through Zara, you had Dara, or Darda was the son of Zara, and you had the Dardanelles, or the Dardanians, who were the Trojans. And of course, legend traced the Trojans to Rome, and also when the Greeks captured Troy around 1100,000 BC, Brutus led a party of Trojans into Britain and founded the Celtic culture in Britain, to which many other Israelites later came. Many of the royal houses of Europe are also of Trojan descent.
Thank you, Dr. Lewis.
well qualified to talk about that. Just in his own personal life, he was born and grew up in England. He spent 12 years living in Africa. He's now in the United States. And for the past 20 years, has been a Church of God pastor. So he can bring to us a great deal of understanding about these subjects. He has taken a great deal of interest in the subject that we're hearing about today. It's been something of interest in him for many years. So I'd like you to give a hearty welcome once again to Mr. Mel Grove.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good to be back. I don't know if it's because I live in the land of television commercials or what, but they keep on asking me to advertise products when I come up here. Don't forget, if you'd like a copy of The Lost Ten Tribes in Prophecy, a new booklet which will be published in a couple of months, just fill out one of these at the information table and hand them in, and one will be sent to you. Also, a free videotape is available, The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel found, which was put together by members of the United Church of God here, excerpts from programs of Herbert Armstrong regarding this particular subject. That is available to you as well if you'd like to take one. I had a friend of mine come and visit recently in Michigan. He and I were members of the church in Rhodesia over 20 years ago during the Civil War in that part of Africa, which resulted eventually in the defeat of Rhodesia and the birth of a new nation, Zimbabwe. Afterwards, this friend left the country and went to South Africa, where something rather similar happened, and then moved to another country. Anyway, he was visiting, and we got to talking about prophecy. And I told him that many people today in the United States and elsewhere, not just in the United States, feel that prophecy is not important, that it's irrelevant to their lives. And he was rather shocked by this. And I said, well, think of the difference in background between many of the people in the Midwestern United States, for example, and yourself. And he thought about it and he said, you know, that's right, he said. You and I have lived through the fulfillment of many of the prophecies of the Bible. And that is so true. Because what we've lived through in the last 50 years is the decline and almost complete fall of the multitude of nations. The title of my lecture this morning is Decolonization and Its Consequences. As was mentioned, I lived in Africa for a number of years, and I've seen Africa from a number of different perspectives. When I worked in Rhodesia, Rhodesia was still run very much along British lines because the Rhodesian government was made up of people of British descent. I've been back to Zimbabwe since a couple of times, but after Rhodesia, my wife and I then lived in Ghana and worked considerably in Nigeria, in Cameroon, which was a French colony, partly British. Two provinces were British and five were French. Also Liberia, which was never colonized. Liberia and Ethiopia were the only two countries in Africa that were never colonized. So I've seen it from a number of different perspectives. South Africa as well, where we used to spend quite a bit of time. So I hope you'll find this presentation interesting. At the end of World War II, Britain and the United States were victorious. It seemed that nobody could get in their way. The Soviet Union was exhausted. Germany and Japan lay in ruins. China was so backward it was inconceivable that it could be a threat to anybody. It was also divided by communists and nationalists and was about to resume a civil war that had begun 20 years previously. Only the US and Great Britain seemed to have any real future. Yet 2 years later, Britain was to lose the jewel in its crown, and 50 years of progressive decline was about to begin. Now, it had effectively already begun. In 1916, in the middle of World War I, a major turning point was reached when Great Britain needed loans from the United States to continue to fight the First World War. That's a major turning point when you have to ask other countries for money, to borrow money, in order to fight a conflict. In 1922, Great Britain had to allow the United States to build a navy that was equal to the size of the Royal Navy. Prior to that time, the British had always acted very quickly when anybody built a navy which even got to 50% of the Royal Navy's size. They went in quickly and sunk it before it could become a threat. But by 1922, they had to allow the U.S. to have a bigger navy. It's interesting that in the 1930s, following the Depression, Britain and most of its colonies recovered much quicker than the United States did. And this was a major cause of resentment on the part of the United States that wanted to break into the imperial trading system. In 1940, Britain was fighting for its life against Hitler's Germany. These are all turning points in Britain's decline. In 1942, another major turning point was the fall of Singapore, perhaps the biggest single turning point. Because when Singapore fell, it was the first time in a couple of hundred years that a European power, a colonial power, had been defeated by non-Europeans. And it was a major turning point in the perception of people. It changed the perceptions of people in different countries. In 1945, there was a general election in Britain itself, which signaled significant change. The British people turned their backs on policing the world and decided to concentrate on themselves instead. Again, a major turning point. So very shortly after that, India was granted independence and Pakistan, and then a year later, Ceylon and Burma. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 4 describes Israel as a father of many nations, and this can certainly be said of Great Britain. About 60 different countries have been created as independent nations by the British during this century, most of them in the last half century, in the last 50 years. Rather interestingly, if you look at dates, it's interesting to me that in the 50 years from August 1947 to June 1997, that was 50 years, almost to the month, all these different nations were created. The British Empire was intact in 47. By 97, with independence for Hong Kong, or the handover of Hong Kong, it was finished. Today, the biggest colonial power in the world, believe it or not, is the United States, because it still has Puerto Rico, which has a few million people, which makes it the biggest colonial power. But Britain was, right up until Hong Kong was handed back to China just a couple of years ago. So in that 50 years, you saw the world radically changed. It's interesting because in 1897, which is exactly 50 years before India's independence, you had the Diamond Jubilee, which was the climax of empire, when it was the, without a doubt, the undisputed major power in the world, the superpower of the world. In giving birth to all these new nations, Britain's record overall was very good, and certainly better than the other colonial powers. No wars like Indochina and Algeria, which the French fought for many years. No wars like Angola or Mozambique, which the Portuguese fought. Rather, there was an acceptance on the part of the British of the need for change in a changing world. In fact, sometimes the British gave independence to countries when they didn't want it, or when they asked for it to be delayed. There was a haste to get rid of the empire, as I'll come to that later on. Almost all the former colonial subjects opted voluntarily to join the Commonwealth as independent nations, which showed a certain desire for continued friendly relations with Britain and other former colonies. Queen Elizabeth is still recognized by all as head of the Commonwealth, so it was reasonably friendly decolonization. But big mistakes were made. I'm going to put my map out again so that you can see some of these places, and I'll point to some of them as well. You don't need to read what's on there, just get the basic idea. It might be a little out of focus, the print, but you can see the rest all right, I think. One big mistake on the part of Britain after World War II was there was an assumption, because of the success of the Dominions, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and South Africa, that the Westminster style of government could be adopted by people of a totally different culture. And that's been one major failing, because the Westminster style of government has not been very successfully transferred to other cultures. I might mention here that I remember when a constitution was being drawn up for the country of Kenya in East Africa, when the British were drafting the constitution with the Kenyan nationalists under Jomo Kenyatta, they had a problem when they were looking for the expression they needed to translate into Swahili, the expression Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition. And there was no word in Swahili for opposition. The nearest word was the word enemy, which of course carries a completely different connotation. And this was just one example of the problems that arose as a result of trying to transfer a system of government which had evolved in Britain over centuries to nations with no direct experience of it. In 1949, another change was that India decided to become a republic and asked if it could remain within the Commonwealth and do so. And this was the first nation in the Commonwealth to replace the king, as it was at that time, with their own president and still remain in the Commonwealth. Today, most of the nations in the Commonwealth are republics. I think 16 are still monarchies out of 51, 52 different countries. Pakistan followed in 1956. Military dictatorships soon followed in Pakistan. Democracy was no longer required to be a member of the Commonwealth. You see how the changes were coming about, rather subtly, but one after another. Now, Ghana's the country I want to talk about for a few moments, because we lived in Ghana for many years, and we loved Ghana. Ghana is a wonderful country. If you can ever visit Africa, Ghana should be top of your list. If you go to Kenya or Zimbabwe or Zambia, there was so much European settlement there in colonial times that those countries have become somewhat westernized. West Africa was not very westernized. Most European settlers did not want to go there because the life expectancy until a cure was found for malaria at the beginning of this century, the life expectancy in West Africa was only 1 year for European settlers. Most settlers went out in the 1800s on 2-year contracts. If they made it to the end of the 2 years, they had enough money to retire on. But unfortunately, half of them died before the 2 years was over. So, you know, they didn't go back with anything. They didn't go back at all, actually. They were left behind back in Ghana. So, Ghana's an interesting case. So Ghana has preserved its African heritage much better than most nations in Africa. And it's a very, very friendly country, a safe country to go to overall. And, you know, I would well recommend it. Ghana was called the Gold Coast in colonial times. It was the most progressive of all Britain's African colonies. That's the Gold Coast there. It was the most progressive of all the colonies in Africa, with a great deal of African advancement that had taken place prior to independence in 1957. Almost every position in the nation had been taken over at some time by different subject peoples, native peoples. Ghana had a parliament that went back about 100 years before independence, and Africans had been represented in that parliament. It also had 3 universities which were built by the British, so it had the most educated people in Africa were in Ghana. A higher proportion of educated people, university graduates, were in Ghana than any other African nation. In contrast, I might mention that when the Belgians left what is now the Congo in 1960, they left behind 9 university graduates to rule a country much, much bigger and more populous than Ghana. But Britain had built 3 universities in Ghana. So a lot of Ghanaians had gone through university. It also had a lot of money in the bank, a lot of reserves, because Ghana, or the Gold Coast, had great reserves of gold. After South Africa and Russia, it was the third biggest gold producer in the world. Additionally, it produced bauxite. Additionally, exported a great deal of timber, and its wonderful beaches and its sunny climate attracted a lot of visitors. So this was a country which economically was very viable. It had progressively been given independence. After World War II, it had its own African chief minister, as he was called, like a prime minister. They still had the governor, and the governor did have the last word on any decisions which the parliament made, but I don't know of any decisions which the governor overruled. So it was a fairly independent country. But I read a book while I was in Ghana by Kwame Nkrumah's secretary, Kwame Nkrumah was the first African prime minister of Ghana after the British left. But as I say, he started in office 6 years before the British gave independence to the country. So he'd had 6 years as prime minister working with the British governor and with the British military there, just, you know, one squadron or whatever. It wasn't that many troops. And the British still controlled the police. But in 1955, when discussing the independence constitution for what was to become Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah made a very interesting comment, and it was recorded by his secretary in her memoirs. Kwame Nkrumah looked at some of the people who were working together to draw up this constitution, and he said, "I can ride a coach and horses through this constitution if I want to." If people had thought about it more deeply at the time, they might have realized that problems were coming. And the problems that were to come in Ghana happened just about everywhere in Africa. In 1957, on March the 6th, when Ghana got its independence, it was set up as a dominion in the same way that Australia and Canada are. There's film, which is shown regularly on Ghanaian television, in documentaries on the lead-up to independence, show the crowds in their tens of thousands carrying banners with the words "Elizabeth and Nkrumah forever" on Ghana's Independence Day. 2 years later, Kwame Nkrumah decided that he didn't like somebody being above him, and he decided that he wanted to be the head of state, and so he persuaded the people to vote for a republic, which they did, and he then became the president of Ghana. A year later, the parliament, National Assembly, voted him in as president for life. A year later, he abolished the parliament. 4 years. In those same 4 years, the country went from having the biggest amount of assets in the bank, 600 million pounds sterling, I think it was at the time, which was a lot of money back in 1957. But it was still a lot of money. I wouldn't mind it myself. But in 1957, it was a great deal. By 1961, not only had all of that money gone, but the country was so heavily in debt that its economy was not to recover until about 1990, 30 years. We lived in the country when it was economically bankrupt. You could hardly buy anything because nothing could be imported into the nation of Ghana. And as a result of the fact that the country was so so destitute, you had never-ending political problems. Once Nkrumah became the president for life, there were only two ways to get rid of him. Either end his life, or alternatively to overthrow him from power and imprison him. As it happened in 1966, while he was out of the country, there was a military coup d'etat, and he was overthrown. The army took over. And then you had a great deal of corruption. You had a lot of corruption under Nkrumah's time as well, but a lot more with the army. And so then the people agitated for a democracy again. So they decided to try a second republic in 1969 and see if that would work. It lasted 26 months. The army took over again. The next leader of Ghana was a man called Ignatius Achampong, who was president when I arrived in the country. And he believed that the way to make the country richer was to print more money, which unfortunately led to hyperinflation of about 600% a year and a total collapse of the economy. My wife and I arrived in the country on May 27th in 1978. 6 weeks later, there was a palace coup where he was removed by fellow officers because of his incompetence. And the new leader then tried to put things right. But the people were suffering so much that in less than a year there was a revolution. And when the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council took over the country on June the 4th, 1979, the first thing that was done was to round up all the previous presidents of Ghana, take them down to the beach, and in front of the public, shoot them all. Same thing happened in Liberia just a few months later, and was to happen in Upper Volta, Burkina Faso, as it is called. Set a trend for Africa. See, these are the kind of political problems that you have. Tribalism made it impossible for Westminster-style democracy to work in Africa. That was another factor. Because when you have a president in many African countries, he will surround himself with people from his own tribe. And the result is then that other tribes feel excluded. So, you know, it stops everybody from having a role in the country. Now, a great deal of this can be blamed on the way that the Europeans drew the borders in Africa, because sometimes borders went right through a country. I just showed you Ghana, for example. If you look to the right of Ghana, there's a little strip there, a sliver there, and that is Togo, the country of Togo. Togo was German before World War I, and became French and British after World War I when Germany was defeated. And the Togo was basically as the Awe tribe, and the British and the French just put a line right through it along a river. The Awe's on the east bank were French, the Awe's on the west bank were British. And so the tribe was divided. So some of these problems were caused by the European powers themselves. But having said that, other problems have been caused since independence. Now looking back, 1956 was a major turning point in the decline of the multitude of nations. Before 1956, India and Pakistan had been given independence, Ceylon and Burma, but the British still considered themselves a great imperial power, and most of the empire was intact, and because India, Pakistan, and Ceylon had opted to remain within the Commonwealth, it was assumed that they, like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, were loyal dominions and would stay so. But in 1956, a significant change took place because Britain lost the Suez Canal. Suez was the lifeline to the Far East, and it had been built by the British and the French to, you know, enable ships to go from the Mediterranean Sea right down to the Red Sea, and enable them to go on to India and Australia and so on. And Britain lost that. In fact, actually, when the Egyptians seized it, the British and French went in with their troops and they took it back. But then the United States forced Britain to give it up because they didn't want their relations with the Arab world to deteriorate and have the Russians move in, which is what happened anyway. So Britain lost Suez. But there was a realization amongst many of Britain's imperial possessions that the British Empire was now finished. I want to read to you a quote from the autobiography of Ian Smith, who was Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia in the 1960s, and who led the country to break from Britain unilaterally in 1965. But it was interesting to read this in his autobiography. It was the Suez Crisis of 1956 which first sounded the alarm and brought those of us associated with Britain and the Empire face to face with the hard reality that Britain could no longer call the tune on the international stage. The United States was now in the driving seat, constantly propagating the philosophy that colonialism was inherently bad and that the pace of its elimination had to be stepped up. The Americans joined forces with the Russians in this anti-colonialist campaign, albeit for opposing reasons. The Russian plan for world conquest, the takeover by Marxism-Leninism. As the metropolitan powers pulled out of their empires, the Russian plan was to move in. The Americans, on the other hand, believed that the presence of the colonial powers was denying them the opportunity to develop in these areas the expertise, skills, and economic success of their free enterprise system, the desire to break into the imperial trading systems. Sadly, they seriously misjudged the situation. The second point, which should have been obvious to the USA, was that wherever Western colonialism was the vogue and the free enterprise system thriving, with American skills, capital, and equipment everywhere, big mining and industrial development, motor cars, heavy transport, earth-moving equipment, all doors were open to everybody, including the Americans. But once the Russians moved in, everybody else was frozen out. So the result turned out to be contrary to the United States' expectations. However, there is no way of correcting these mistakes. We have to live with them. This is easy for the Americans. They live 10,000 kilometers away and could go on living their own lives. The problem lies with the people on the spot who have to go on living with the disaster forced onto them. The truth of this will become patently clear as the rest of my story unfolds. I think that's a very interesting passage, and it's very perceptive. The fact is, as another book I want to read some extracts from points out, decolonization in Africa has been a disaster. Now I want to read to you some extracts from a book by a Ghanaian, George Ayate. This is a native Ghanaian who now teaches in the United States. He had to flee from Ghana during the military dictatorship in the 1970s. And Ayate wrote a book called Africa Betrayed. If you can get a copy, it's a very interesting read. But he talks about how, first of all, he mentions that Africa has been invaded three times. The first time was by the Arabs. As David mentioned yesterday, the Arabs had a great empire. It moved south as well into countries like what is now Ghana. Next to come were the European explorers, Christian missionaries, and slave traders in the 15th century. Now, he has some very strong criticism of all of them in his book. But let's move on to the next part. Well, he does mention this regarding Europeans. Africa was carved up into colonies and transformed into economic appendages of European colonial powers. Boundaries were artificially drawn up with little regard to demographic configurations. The Ghana-Togo border, for example, ran right through the Ewe community, as I mentioned. But then he mentions the third invasion. A third and far more insidious invasion began under black neo-colonialism around the time of independence, just before and just after. Educated abroad and having assumed the trappings of foreign cultures and ideologies, a new wave of invaders struck Africa. They were actually returnees, sons of Africa, who briefly left to pursue studies overseas or go into exile. But they came back with a vengeance to denigrate, to enslave, to destroy, and to colonize by imposing alien ideological systems upon the African people. Now, as it happens, many of these ideas had come from the British Labour Party and the French Labour and Communist parties, because many of the Africans went to the mother country for their education and then went back to Africa ready to take over the country as the nationalist movement led to independence. The economic exploitation and political repression of the African people after independence continued unabated. More treacherous, perhaps, was the continued denigration and, in some cases, the destruction of indigenous African institutions and culture by the very African nationalists and heads of state who claimed to have liberated Africa. From what? Economically, politically, and culturally, Africans today in the 1990s are worse off than they ever were at the time of independence in the 1960s. Africa, in fact, in terms of standard of living, is the only continent to have reversed itself in the last 40 years. Three decades of independence from colonial rule have produced nothing but economic misery and disintegration, political chaos, and institutional and social decay. As oppressive as colonial rule was, almost all the nationalists who struggled against it for independence emerged alive to lead their countries after independence. But few Africans would be lucky to survive even 2 years in the jails of independent Africa. You think of Nelson Mandela in prison for, 30 years roughly? He survived. But you disagree with the government in other African countries, and you're soon dead. One word of criticism of an African government may earn a death sentence. That's what he wrote. And he's a Ghanaian. Most analysts now agree that although colonialism was evil, it offered comparatively more freedom than did many independent African countries in the 1980s. By 1990, the political regimes instituted in most African countries were indistinguishable from the abominable system of apartheid or institutionalized racism in South Africa. In fact, the oppression of blacks in some independent African countries was even worse. These are comments, again, by George Ayate. Ayate is a very popular name in Ghana. And I found that book very interesting from a Ghanaian perspective. As he points out, there was a great deal wrong with the colonial system. Looking back, I think we can see the colonial system was better than what's replaced it. But having said that, neither was run along the kind of lines that the Bible would say a country should be run. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 16, there's an interesting passage of scripture which I think is very applicable in the African context, because I mentioned to you how at independence, Africans who had gone to the mother country to receive an education came back to Africa. They led the independence movements. They took over their countries. Initially, the country was run along democratic lines, but until fairly recently, there was no election, no free election in an independent African country that resulted in a change of government. So every country soon became a dictatorship. And almost every leader believed that the government should control just about everything. And the result was that all these nations and their economies went backwards. What was fairly typical, what happened in most countries was this. That in the first 5 years after independence, the number of Europeans in the country would be reduced by 50%. As Africanization was speeded up, so, you know, a lot of the European civil servants and business managers and so on would go back to the country that they came from, and people from the local community would take over their jobs. And as a result of that 50% leaving, the income tax that the government was receiving in each of these countries would decline. But at the same time, and this is fairly common in all African countries, I can't think of any exceptions, after independence, in the first 5 years, the number of civil servants would be doubled. So whereas the revenue the governments were receiving was cut by about 50%, the amount of money the government was spending increased by 100%, which, as you know, is not possible economically without some very severe consequences. And what tended to happen, too, is that when an independent government came into office, the dominant tribe in the government, the people in the government, would bring in their friends and relatives, nepotism, as it's known, and give them some of the nicest jobs with lots of money. I'll give you an example of that. I went to stay at a hotel in Ghana and took quite a few friends from the United States there 1 year. We invited them down and we stayed at this beach hotel. And the owner of the hotel was somebody I knew, and he had 49 children. More than one wife, I might add. But he had 49 children. And he employed all of them in his hotel. Now, he was constantly telling me that he couldn't make ends meet. And I could soon see why, because only two of those 49 seemed to do anything. But you see, under the custom, he had to, you know, take in all these people, and also cousins and, you know, others as well that were working there. So there's no wonder he did not run at a profit. And when you do that in government, you're going to have problems too. Now, the first presidents of most African countries were quite well educated, but as the people got worse and worse off, suffering under these changes, then the military would intervene. And the military had attracted a lot of people who were not very well educated. They couldn't really get anywhere in life, so they joined the military. In Ecclesiastes 10, there's an interesting scripture in verse 16. It says, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes eat in the morning." There's another translation of that. "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a slave." Which, you know, what it's talking about is that sometimes a nation, you know, will be taken over by somebody who is totally ill-equipped to run it from the very bottom echelons of society in terms of education. And that has happened repeatedly in Ghana. I could name African presidents who could not even read or write. But they managed to get power because they had the guns. And all it takes is six people to take over a country. That was illustrated a number of times in West Africa. You take over the radio station, you take over the airport, you've got the country, basically. The radio station, you proclaim yourselves in charge. The airport, you stop anybody from leaving. So, you've got the country, you see. Only takes six people. Usually more, but six was all it took in the Gambia to overthrow the government, for example. And, you know, then, when you get a person take over, totally ill-equipped like that, you know, power goes to his head. So it's talking about princes who eat in the morning. They haven't had enough to eat all their lives. Now suddenly they're ruling the country, so they don't stop eating. And, you know, we often, I mean, Ghanaians would comment on this, just how when a president took over, he was thin. Within 6 months, he was huge, see. You know, and that often happened. It happened in Ghana with the presidents there. We had one president who took over who, you know, increasingly every time he came on television to speak to the people, was more inebriated than he was the previous time. And again, these are problems that you repeatedly see. "Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles and your princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness." So it's talking there about a better form of government. Now, It's sad what has happened to Africa, and the people have suffered. The people, you know, have gone backwards economically. They're not as well off as they used to be. And there's been a great deal of suffering on the part of the people, and that's this very sad thing that has taken place. Let's look at it from Britain's perspective now, because we're talking about the multitude of nations. Proverbs 14 and verse 34 is very interesting here. Proverbs 14 and verse 34. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. You know, Britain was exalted at one time amongst the nations. In fact, in Ghana, it was embarrassing. When I first got there, you know, I could tell from things that people said to me that they kind of held us in awe because we were British. And I had people in my church tell me, we know that an Englishman cannot lie. And I had to tell them, well, that isn't true. You know, anybody can lie. An Englishman lie just like anybody else does. But this was the mindset of the common people, so to speak, regarding the British at that time. So it shows that, you know, they held the British in high esteem. Hosea chapter 13. Hosea is a book that deals a great deal with Ephraim. When Ephraim spoke trembling before God, in fear of God, he exalted himself in Israel, exalted himself amongst the other Israelite nations that David's been talking about. But when he offended in Baal, when he turned away from God, he died. You know, he wasn't exalted anymore. He came down. And now they sin more and more and have made them molten images of their silver and idols according to their own understanding. All of it the work of the craftsman. In other words, pursuing all these material goods, which is basically, you know, what has happened. As I mentioned, in the election of 1945, the British people rejected Winston Churchill and they opted to basically get more and more for themselves and turn their backs on the empire and turn their backs on the responsibilities of policing the world. And that has happened, as it says in the book of Hosea. Now what is interesting is that a total 180 degree turn in Britain's foreign policy was taking place. I want to, just for a few moments, contrast two Elizabeths. Elizabeth I, who was Queen of England from 1558 to 1603, when she became queen, England was just England by itself, well, with Wales and one or two islands around, you know, around there. And that was England. And I mentioned yesterday how she saw the need in order for England to preserve its religious freedom from the Roman Church, for England to look for trade beyond Europe and also to build the strongest navy to defend itself, having the advantage of being an island to begin with. And so Elizabeth I laid the foundation for Britain's foreign policy, because after her death, the next king was the King of England and Scotland, so then it became Great Britain. So Elizabeth I laid a foundation for Britain's foreign policy, and that foreign policy was to look beyond the seas for its trade and its security, which of course laid the foundation of empire. Under Elizabeth II, we've seen a total reversal of this policy. Not because of any decision that Elizabeth II has made, because she is a constitutional monarch. But I find it interesting that, you know, at the beginning of Elizabeth II's reign, a lot of people hoped that it would be another Elizabethan age, an age of glory, so to speak. But it's turned out instead to be the exact opposite, an era of decay and constant decline. Her reign began, Elizabeth II's reign began, with the multitude of nations fairly intact. I want to just show you an extract from a film of the coronation. I was trying to find on this film, before we started, exactly where the Queen is crowned as Queen of the different countries, like Australia, Canada, United Kingdom, and so on. I couldn't find it in time. But I do want to show you that after the coronation was over, when all the troops marched through the streets of London, the diversity of peoples that you see on this film. You'll see Australian troops there, and you'll see troops from different countries that were all a part of the multitude of nations. Just a 3-minute excerpt here, and I'll be back.
And now, amid cheering crowds, the Queen was escorted back to the palace with a magnificent parade made up of soldiers, sailors, airmen and police from all parts of the Commonwealth.
That, incidentally, did not reflect the diversity of the Diamond Jubilee in 1897, so decline had already set in, so to speak. But I don't think we're going to see anything like that ever again. The next coronation will not show that diversity of peoples. But in 1953, 46 years ago, when that coronation took place, Britain by that time had slipped to third place after the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of the world power structure. The Indian subcontinent was already independent. India had become the first republic in the Commonwealth, therefore showing a move away to a different kind of Commonwealth. Nationalists had seized power in Egypt, overthrowing King Farouk, and were ready to seize the Suez Canal, this other turning point. The Afrikaner Nationalist Party was in power in the Union of South Africa, dedicated to removing the Queen and breaking away from the British Commonwealth. The Mau Mau were beginning their campaign of terror in Kenya, which later became Kenya. And coincidentally, that is where Princess Elizabeth received the news that her father had died, and she was queen while she was in Kenya. Britain had had to devalue sterling against the dollar in 1949, which reduced the assets of almost all the Commonwealth members. So, again, that showed economic decline taking place. Great Britain had already lost her industrial preeminence earlier in the century to the United States. Britain was heavily in debt to the U.S. as a result of World War II, and socialism was the prevailing mood of the day. Even the conservatives in Britain had to placate the demands of the people for more, thereby reducing the ability to defend the empire. So all of those things were true in 1953 when Elizabeth ascended the throne. But in the reign of the second Elizabeth, Britain was to dismantle its empire and set out on a course that would involve her increasingly in European affairs, a total reversal of the foreign policy of the last 400 years. I'll be talking more about that this afternoon, about the implications of what is happening in Europe. But I want to ask the question here, has anybody benefited from this change? I listed yesterday seven blessings, which I thought, looking at the scriptures and also from my own knowledge of history and the experience that I had in different parts of the world, seven blessings which had come about as a result of the multitude of nations. The first was political stability. Just think about that for a moment in the context of the Commonwealth that has replaced it. Most Commonwealth nations have not had a good record of political stability, without which economic progress is much more difficult. There has been no functioning democracy in Africa until South Africa, and South Africa now has only had 5 years, so it's a little early to tell. But, it's just not been a very good record as far as political stability goes. There's one or two minor nations, by the way, that have done reasonably well, like Botswana, for example, but it only has a couple of million people. But in Asia, you see also the countries of the Commonwealth there. Many of them have had dictatorships. Some, like Sri Lanka, have had civil war, for example. Some nations have been fairly stable and have prospered, but they've had to take some of the freedoms away from the people, like Singapore, for example, and Malaysia. So, no country that I can think of has actually, benefited as far as the politics go since independence. Security was the second thing I mentioned as a blessing. Is any member of the Commonwealth as secure as it was when the multitude of nations functioned as the world's dominant power? No, nobody is. Britain is not secure anymore, nor is Australia, New Zealand, Canada. The countries of Africa, none of them are secure. The Asian countries, India, perhaps more secure than most because of its size. But, security really has gone for everybody. And yet 100 years ago, the people in all of these countries felt very secure. The third thing I mentioned was the freedoms that people were given. By George Ayate's estimation in his book, most of the subjects of the crown are less free than they were politically, economically, and in terms of freedom to worship since independence. Fourthly, regarding law, there has been a general downturn in law and order throughout the Commonwealth, throughout most countries, including Australia and Britain. Religion, religious freedom, religious conflict has become a major problem in the Indian subcontinent and throughout Africa. I was in Ghana at a time when, on the news one night, the president announced the banning of a number of different churches. And I sat there so nervous, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, I thought, you know, are we going to be banned? I'd already been told to leave the country once after the revolution, which was a Marxist revolution. And all church ministers had to leave the country. I was given 48 hours to leave the country on a Friday afternoon. So I had to be out by Sunday afternoon. But I had to get an exit visa to leave the country, so I had to get permission to leave the country, and that department was closed down until Monday. So, you know, this was the kind of thing that we sometimes experienced when your rights are taken away, you see, and this is fairly typical in dictatorships. In terms of economic development, the sixth blessing I mentioned yesterday, well, Africa and the Caribbean have had their economic development reversed. Maybe not elsewhere, but certainly in those places. And the multitude of nations itself is no longer a concept. All international threats today must be addressed by the United Nations. And usually, if any action is taken, it is with American leadership, which makes us all dependent on the U.S. political system and their elections, which determine basically, you know, whether things are done or not. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a good chapter to look at in this, because it helps us to understand why all this has happened, why this decline has taken place in the last 48 years, the last 46 years, or 50 years, however you want to start counting it. In Deuteronomy verse 1 of chapter 28, it says, "It shall come to pass, if you shall hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord your God, to observe and to do all his commandments which I command you this day, that the Lord your God will set you on high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come on you and overtake you if you shall hearken unto the voice of the Lord your God." And then all these blessings are listed. But the reverse is also true, beginning in verse 15. "It shall come to pass, if you will not hearken unto the voice of the Lord your God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city and in the field," and so on. See, as a nation turns away from God, as a people turn away from God, so that nation then declines in stature around the world, in power and influence. There's another interesting passage in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning in verse 43 and 44. Remember that all those territories that you saw on the map up there, if I can turn that back on for a moment, you see, you can see all the different countries up there. You know, 60 or more different countries. What is often forgotten is that although most of these countries were populated mostly by people who were not physical Israelites, the rulers were, the leaders were of Ephraim. The Viceroy of India, for example, was the most powerful man in the world. He was appointed by the British government, and he had absolute authority over the peoples of India. I mean, they had their own parliament, but the Viceroy could overrule anything if he wanted to. And so all of these countries, in effect, were Ephraim. And there's an interesting passage in Deuteronomy 28. It says, "The stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high." So, you know, the non-Israelites within you, within those territories which you have, shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. "He shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail." That's exactly what has happened with country after country. Now, the implications of that are interesting. I mean, think for a moment about the Second World War. I checked a book out of the library here on Friday, and it's very interesting. I only managed to read the first four chapters in the middle of the night when adjusting to the time difference. The book is called Our War, How the British Commonwealth Fought the Second World War, by Christopher Somerville. It's a fairly new book, and it quotes from a lot of people, Africans, Indians, Malaysians, and so on, who contributed to the war effort, Australians as well, Canadians. And it's the role that all these nations played in helping Britain win of the Second World War. People forget, especially in Britain, that the war was an imperial effort, but all the nations of the Commonwealth helped Britain. Without those nations, I don't think Britain would have survived. It would have been taken over by the Third Reich, and the whole history of the world would have been changed. But, you know, what happened was most of these territories in Africa were colonies. The Viceroy of India, when he heard the news about Britain declaring war on Germany, the Viceroy declared on behalf of India. And 2.5 million Indian men volunteered to fight for Britain. That is the biggest volunteer army in the history of the world. 2.5 million. Think what a difference that made to the imperial war effort. The people of Ghana, for example, many of them volunteered. There was no conscription. The people in the Gold Coast, or Ghana, Nigeria, when they volunteered, they were sent to fight the Japanese in Malaya and up in Burma because they could handle the climate better. And so many of them went over there. Now, that had an effect also of you know, spreading the independence movement that was in India into Africa, because some of those African troops that went to India listened to Mahatma Gandhi at his meetings and went back with ideas, which then started the independence movements in some of the African nations. But, you know, again, all these people helped. South Africa, in South Africa, the parliament couldn't decide on whether to declare war or not because the Afrikaners were sympathetic to Hitler, or many of the Afrikaners were. And so the Governor General decided to take it into the war anyway, so he made that decision. Australia, of course, New Zealand, immediately the war began, declared war on Germany. Canada took a few days because it wanted to emphasize its independence after the Statute of Westminster, but Canada, you know, it declared war, I think, just a few days after the Second World War began. So all of these nations then contributed, all of them. Today, you know, all those nations are independent countries. If the same situation arose today, exactly the same situation, Britain would pretty much be on its own. It might get one or two nations that might help, but nobody else. So, you know, it's ironic that after the Second World War, within just a few weeks, when there was an election in Britain, and you had, you know, Winston Churchill, who was an imperialist, he believed in the multitude of nations, and the choice was between him and Clement Attlee with the Labour government that wanted to start dismantling all of this. The people chose to begin dismantling it because they were tired of fighting wars. But what they didn't understand was without the multitude of nations, they were going to become very, very vulnerable. And that realization has only really dawned on the people fairly recently with the complications that have arisen as a result of becoming a part of Europe. The United States, of course, something similar has happened there as well, because the United States, after 1898, when it defeated Spain 100 years ago, became a colonial power. It took control of the Philippines over there in blue and took control of some islands, you know, in the Caribbean and in the Pacific. And the United States has lost the Philippines. The Philippines got its independence at the end of the Second World War. But additionally, America has lost the bases, its military bases there. The Philippines, 5 or 6 years ago, asked the Americans to leave. And now America this year is losing the Panama Canal, which you know, has been America's lifeline in terms of trade, going right through the Central American isthmus there. And you've got the you know, the Atlantic Ocean there and the Pacific Ocean. You know, it really has enabled America to trade much more effectively, and of course also was very strategic in terms of defending that whole area. So, you know, it's all basically gone in 50 years. All we're left with today in terms of what the multitude of nations stood for, in terms of, you know, democracy, the rule of law, and, you know, the freedoms that it stood for. Basically today you've just got the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, maybe, you know, one or two other countries, or the nations of Western Europe, of course, but, you know, they're tied up in a different system, which, again, I say we'll talk about this afternoon. Hosea chapter 5 mentions something interesting in the context of the last days of Israel, the last days of Ephraim. It says in verse 5, the pride of Israel does testify to his face. You know, we still, as a people, you know, feel that because, you know, we were victorious, in quotes, in Kosovo and the Persian Gulf, you know, that we're unassailable, practically unassailable, that nothing can defeat us. But I think if you look more closely at some of these things, you realize our weaknesses. Now, therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. So Israel, Ephraim, Judah, falling at the same time. Judah, the Jews in the Middle East, the nation of Israel. Ephraim, the multitude of nations, and Israel, which predominantly today is the United States, but you know there's other nations in Western Europe as well. They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek the Lord. The implication here is that they've not been going before God. Now suddenly when they realize we're going to be defeated, they all go before God. But they shall not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord. For they have begotten strange children, strangers to God, because a lot of our young people in our nations today have no idea about what this book says, about the beliefs that built up our civilization. Now shall a month devour them with their portion. So, you know, when the final blow comes, it is very quick, and it's with their portions too, which probably is with reference to places like, you know, Gibraltar and the Falkland Islands and, you know, maybe even Australia and New Zealand, further away from where the bulk of the people of Ephraim and Israel are. I would think the inevitable result of the decline of the multitude of nations, because over the last 50 years, it seems that whenever a decision has been made by Britain, or by the Commonwealth nations, whenever a decision has had to be made, always the wrong decision is made. And so the decline has been progressive, but in 50 years, we've gone from that, pretty much intact, as it was, to nothing, really, other than Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, as Commonwealth nations that still believe in the old values, the old Commonwealth, as it's called. This leads to the inevitable question, as the British Empire and Commonwealth was replaced by the United States. Who will replace the United States as the world's dominant power? And what does it mean for the British, American, and Australian people? And that's what I want to talk about this afternoon. Are there any questions? Be happy to answer any questions. Yeah. Yeah, much of it has been. I wouldn't say all of it, because there's a lot of factors have been involved. I think it, in a way that the attitude the United States has taken to the empire goes back, of course, to the Revolutionary War. That I mean, I noticed this in Ghana, that when a country gets its independence, then it has to start propaganda to build up the new country. So as Ghana got its independence, so the propaganda started. And as the country deteriorated, so the propaganda against colonialism became greater. And so you had a generation then grow up that blamed all its problems on the colonialists, when, as George Ayotte shows in his book, the problem since independence can be put squarely on the shoulders of the people that have ruled the countries in Africa in the last 40 years. And I think America must have done the same thing when it broke away from England, that they had all this, you know, propaganda to kind of unify the country and build it up and separate it from Great Britain. So colonialism became an evil in the eyes of most Americans, in spite of the fact that, you know, rather contradictorily, they were practicing a form of it with the slavery, which they continued well beyond the time when the British Empire abolished slavery. So you had a situation where a lot of Americans were very much against colonial rule. President Wilson, in the First World War, made it clear to the British, when America came to the aid of Britain financially, that he was very much against colonialism and kind of backed away from it. Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's wife, prior to the Second World War and during the Second World War, was very critical of Britain's ruling India, for example, and you know, the she kind of pushed for the statement in the UN founding charter that spoke out against colonialism and gave the people the right to, you know, break away from the power that was over them. So, yeah, Americans contributed to that a great deal. But also, socialism did. But I think a lot of it is just a naivete. You see, there is an assumption, and I can understand it. If I had never lived in Africa, maybe I would think this way too. And I try to think of what I thought before I went. I was actually brought up a communist, by the way. My father was a Marxist-Leninist. Instead of having the Bible read to me as a child, I had the Essentials of Lenin and the Communist Manifesto read to me as a child. I don't believe in them anymore, in case you have any doubts. But, you know, I would mention that, you know, I think back then I used to think, well, you know, everybody's the same, and why should we rule these different countries? But when you go to Africa, you realize that the African people have suffered greatly. There were abuses under colonialism. I mean, I remember in